Welcome to Real Talk, real estate discussions with Andrew Kirsch. In each episode, Andrew interviews industry leaders. We'll hear their real-time opinions on today's market, their background and unique career highlights, and guidance for newcomers to the industry. You can find this show at www.sklarkirsch.com and on YouTube, LinkedIn, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts and more. Now here's the host of Real Talk, Andrew Kirsch.
Episode 13 of Real Talk. Last week, I was at the NMHC conference in Las Vegas, the largest multifamily apartment conference of the year. I have never seen so much optimism at a conference before where literally no one is doing deals. Sponsors, operators on the one hand, equity providers on the other. They're all looking forward to pounce on transactions once the market stabilizes. Hopefully last week's Fed announcement where the rate increase went down to only a quarter point and their narrative will bring some stability to the marketplace. I heard phrases like no price discovery or the bid-ask spread is too wide, literally 1,000 times. The one subset of multifamily that is absolutely on fire, affordable housing. Groups who have significant experience in this area are in high demand. There's lots of capital that want this exposure and have sizable deals. So both in development and in existing product. I would say the last thought of NMHC, going to a nightclub in Vegas with 2,000 people, mostly male in blue blazers. It's like going to a bad 30-year high school reunion. Even the Vegas DJ had to modulate his playlist for this crowd. So for this week, I have Chris Tortolet, the managing director of Laterra Development. Laterra is one of the fastest growing and largest developers based here in Southern California. They do multifamily development, self-storage development in California, New Mexico, Texas. I believe they have almost $3 billion in development. We talk about a ranging of issues from what it's like to develop in California, capitalizing deals that are entitled and also not entitled, using international pension funds to help capitalize their deals, and a little story about how Chris scared the hell out of an entire restaurant here in Century City by the banging of a gong. Let's get to my conversation with Chris.
Thanks for having me.
So, Chris, you know, there's so much we can talk about from Laterra Development, your programmatic joint venture with Fry's Development, or Fry's store, electronic stores, your Snow Globe concert series, what you do with a gong at the closing of every deal. There's so much to cover, not enough time. But first, let's let my audience know, what is Laterra Development?
Sure. So we are an LA-based residential and mixed-use developer. And I think it's fair to characterize us as one of the most active developers in the southwestern U.S. We've got something like 3,000 units currently in development, about 1 million square feet of commercial. We think the value of all that at build out is around $3 billion. Wow. We have a residential platform, which includes apartments and build to rent. We have a self-storage company as well. So we're building, developing self-storage in a JV. We could talk more about that too. But that's really, in a nutshell, Laterra. We also have an affiliate general contractor, which we're using to build our projects, kind of gives us a strategic advantage, we think, in this market to try to be on time, on budget. And so that's kind of the quick high level on Laterra.
Yeah. Now, I mean, in where we sit here in today's market, January, or we're filming January 2023, I'm sure it'll be published next month. You know, the market overall for transactions has slowed down considerably with one caveat, development. And so how is your pipeline? I mean, it sounds like $3 billion of pipeline, did you say?
Yeah.
And so are you actively looking for new deals, or are you currently focusing on just getting through the pipeline that you have now?
Sure. And I would say that development is slowing down just by nature of the fact it's pretty damn hard to get a good construction loan right now, right? And capital is largely on the sidelines, not entirely, but largely. But right now we're executing on our existing pipeline. We'll be completing or are completing and have completed multiple assets, right? Over the last, few months and into the next couple of months, we'll be in lease up on close to a couple thousand units here in greater LA, which is very exciting. But we're also executing on our current pipeline in terms of, we have deals that are in entitlement. We have deals that are in pre-con. We have deals that are under construction, a bunch of stuff leasing up. And that involves different people within Laterra on our entitlement team, our construction team, development team. But we're out looking for new opportunities, right? Like everybody, we want to find the right deal. People are looking for distress. I think there might be some of that in the market, maybe not as much as people think, other than, say, office, for example. And other folks who maybe are too highly levered on bridge debt. But generally, I don't think there'll be a lot of it. But we're looking for good opportunities and we're finding them, right? And those are mostly in apartment development, build to rent, and then also in the self-storage business. We've got, I mentioned, a programmatic venture with Macquarie out of Sydney, Australia. And we're out developing and acquiring self-storage assets. So those are really the three areas that we see the most opportunity right now.
I mean, there's so many different ways we can take this podcast, but you mentioned one thing about how much development you're doing in LA. And earlier this morning, I was with a client. They're not a developer; they're an owner-operator, large owner-operator of multifamily, and they just don't know how if they have the stomach to buy anything more, both in Los Angeles or in California in general. And I know this is probably a conversation piece that you have internally, conversation piece with equity partners. So what are your thoughts on the development climate in LA, and really speaking to the political, just the political nature of Southern California, both doing business in this community and being a landlord?
Yeah. Well, it's difficult, right? There's a lot of red tape. And many of our capital partners are shifting their focus away from California, not entirely, but a bit. Even we are a bit, right? We have an office. We now have a guy in Dallas. We have a deal, our first deal in Dallas, Texas. We might have a second. We have a deal in Albuquerque. So we've gone sunbelting a bit, right? People are looking for lower tax living, warm and sunny climates. Millennials are forming households at record rates. They want more space. So migration patterns have changed and behavior patterns have changed quite a bit since the onset of COVID. That's being exasperated by some of the political constraints imposed by California. So that is a concern of ours, right? ULA, the transfer tax, that's a big one. So we are shifting our focus away from the city of Los Angeles in particular, California to a lesser extent, into some of these other regions. That being said, there's still a lot of good opportunity here in California, right? People have been saying this about California for years, too much regulation. There's concerns about that. You look back over the last couple of decades, people made a lot of money in California, and those who sat out look back and regret it. Right now, we're moving into, some people think a recession or certainly disruptions in the capital markets. And California, like LA, for example, in particular, will hold up pretty well in that kind of environment. So there's a reason why people invest here. So you just need to go into the deal and underwrite it correctly, right? You got to have the transfer tax in there. You got to use realistic assumptions and realistic timelines. We're an expert within these markets. We've entitled 30 projects with a 100% success rate. Most of that in California. I don't know if there's another developer, in the state of California or nationally who can say that. I don't know, but we've done a lot of it. And so we know the system really well. We know the most recent CEQA tools that we can use and take advantage of to expedite the timeline and reduce the risk as much as possible. And we're doing that and have done it. And so there for us, there's opportunity in those same challenges, right? We're exploiting that. We're doing it in a good way. And at the same time, we're providing much needed housing. And there's a lot of tailwinds within the state for producing housing. And that's what we're doing. I think it's just being balanced about it and being thoughtful and smart. But overall, yeah, I mean, we're shifting our focus to some other markets at the same time.
When you're entitling these projects, and these aren't small projects, these are especially the one in Burbank here is, I mean, what is it, close to 1,000 units?
So we got two big ones in Burbank. One is 573 units under construction right now. Another is the Fry's Electronics site in Burbank. We got it fully entitled for 862. Mm-hmm. So between the two, you know, you're whatever, 1,500 units.
I mean, 14 to 1,500 new units coming online in a market like Burbank. When you are entitling these, I'll call them mega projects. I mean, these are large deals, large apartment communities, and you're working with governmental officials and governmental agencies. Do you bring up the fact that, you know, the regulatory environment of California and Southern California is such that it is hard to do business and that you're looking elsewhere, not to just dwell on this one topic, but you know, you're not building just 30, 50, 100 units. You're building, you know, into the thousands, and you're making a major dent in providing a lot more housing into the Southern California market.
We are absolutely doing our best to educate legislators, state and local officials, about the challenges and the complexities of building in the state of California. And we're doing our best to break down those barriers and educate as much as we can. And I think we've made a difference. So yes is the answer. That being said, California, unlike many states, has some really cool legislation that supports the construction of new housing, right? The Housing Accountability Act is one. If you comply with all objective zoning standards, the city has no choice but to approve you. They have to approve you. And they do, right? So if you're a housing project, particularly if you have a component of affordable, you're going to get a significant amount of support from the city. It's a lot easier to get those types of project approved now than it was before. The challenge becomes CEQA, right? There are people who take advantage of CEQA. Green mail folks are, you know, suing developers under the context of CEQA. But there's also tools now that allow developers to proceed smoothly through CEQA and CEQA exemptions. And so we're trying to navigate all that. But yeah, I mean, we're trying to educate, and do what we can to help make housing easier to and faster to produce.
Sure. What's the average timeline in a California city from the day you submit or you start conversations with the community officials to getting a building permit?
It depends on the CEQA document that you use. Mm-hmm. It could be fast as like 9 to 12 months is like fast. Took us 4 years to do our first Burbank deal, EIR, and also we were forging new territory. There were basically nothing's been built in Burbank in 20 years, right? So, but I would say like an average might be like 18 months, 15 to 18 months, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So when you're looking at new opportunities or even the opportunities that you have done and that are in the pipeline over the last, call it 24 to 36 months, what was it, is it covered land plays? Is it just, you're not concerned about the in-place income? It's just more about the acreage and its location. So what are the characteristics that you are looking for, to have as the next Laterra development site?
In California or anywhere?
Well, let's start, I guess, in California, and how does that distinguish from other locations?
Yeah. So from a big picture, we're looking at supply-demand fundamentals, right? We want to be in markets that have good supply-demand fundamentals at the end of the day, right? So California certainly has supply constraints, but there are submarkets within, let's say, city of LA, like downtown or Koreatown or parts of Hollywood, where we would not go and have not gone because there's a bit more supply. So it's all about the supply-demand dynamics. Like we like Mar Vista, for example. We have projects there. We like Burbank. We like Culver City, West LA, right? So it starts there. Then we look at the underlying zoning. We want to make sure that it allows for our intended use. And we try to see if we're within a certain distance of a transit transit stop? Can we use a CEQA exemption tool or an expediting tool to make it faster? We look at that. Can we option land whereby we're not buying it unentitled, but we're putting up some hard money, entitling it, and then closing at the end of entitlements? We like that. So those are the initial things that we look at, but we want to make sure the deal underwrites, want to make sure we're getting the right yield and getting paid for the risk at the end of the day.
Yeah. We'll, so you mentioned having a structure, which we commonly use with developers, of an option structure where you know, after an initial due diligence period, you'll have a certain amount of money non-refundable. And then over periods of time during the option period, you know, in 6 month increments or 12 month increments, provide more non-refundable money. And then once you get your entitlements, you know, then shortly thereafter, take down the site. You know, how often do you use that structure? How willing are sellers to that structure versus a more traditional, you know, 30, 60, 90 days of diligence and then another 30, 60, 90 days to close, and thus you're closing without getting entitlements?
Good question. We always try to option the land, right, to minimize the capital outlay and risk. But a lot of times sellers want to close fast, and that's been our strategic advantage. We can close pretty quick. There's oftentimes a unique story, right? There's family members who are fighting, or the guy's got a divorce or whatever, and he has to sell, right? So it's like he doesn't want to wait a year or 2 years. And so sometimes we close quickly, right? In fact, we closed on a big land buy in Marina Del Rey. Thank you for all your hard work on that, by the way. We got that done. And that's a great deal for us. We'll build 210 apartments. And that one we closed quickly. But other deals like Burbank, right? We optioned that for several years, which was great, and closed on that. So it's probably half and half. We try to option whenever we can. If we're going to close faster, we want to pay less, basically.
Yeah. And you know, in my conversations with a lot of clients who are developers, one of the challenges beyond the thousands of challenges of being a developer is the different types of capital that are available during the different stages of your ownership. There's a very small set of capital that's willing to go in at the non-entitled stage. So such as your Marina Del Rey property versus your other projects where you have that long lead time, you're closing with entitlements. Now you have a whole different bucket of capital at your disposal. So talk about how you capitalize your transactions. I guess I would start with the Marina Del Rey one specifically, where you didn't get entitlements to close and you're closing on unentitled land.
Yeah. So you're right. There are different ways to structure the cap stack, and different partners will come in at the different lifestyle or life cycle. You're spot on with that. We can use a co-GP, you know, family office to acquire land that's unentitled, process entitlements, and then bring in an institutional LP equity partner. Fortunately for us, probably in part because we've entitled 30 deals with 100% success rate, we've kind of proven our track record. We now have most of our LPs, our big institutional LPs, you know, whether it's, you know, a Canadian pension fund like in Marina Del Rey or other big investment fund managers, you know, or whoever, they're willing to close on unentitled land with us now, which has been good. We've been doing that, but it took some time, right, and a track record to establish. However, I'll caveat that by saying that's all, quote, as of right, meaning we're not seeking zone changes. We're not seeking general plan amendments. We're not asking for anything, right? So we clearly, you know, feel good about it. And then typically in those instances too, it's a covered land play, right? So in the unlikely event you're not successful, you know, you can get your money back or more.
Yeah. Well, what percentage of the deals that you buy or the land that you buy are covered land plays where it's generating sufficient income to, assuming if you are getting financing on the land, so just a land loan, where you are getting rent to cover your expenses?
You know, I would say, this is how I would say it. We look at the bridge loan interest is high. We're not going to get it covered. So pretty much never. However, what we do is make sure that if we have to sell and we're, you know, we're unsuccessful, we can at least get our money back. I guess we've got, you know, in some instances, you know, we don't always use bridge loans, but if we do, in some instances, we have some lower cost bridge loans, lower leverage where we're covering it. But really, I just look at it as, you know, can we go and sell it and get our money back at the end? And if the answer is yes, then you have significant upside and very little downside. That's a deal you should do.
Yeah. So in terms of the capital that you have been able to obtain, you know, you've mentioned a Canadian group, an Australian group. I mean, you guys are crisscrossing the globe in terms of capital inflow. Is that a coincidence, or is there a strategy of non-US equity providers that are attracted to Laterra developments?
Good question. We've come a long way back years ago.
Why don't you talk about the history of the company and then you know, talk about how your equity has evolved over time.
Yeah, I think that's actually a great way to frame it. So founded in 2009 by my dad. And then I came down, I was at Prudential in San Francisco. I came down in 2015. At the time, before I joined, we were largely entitling land, doing some single family home and townhome development, selling for sale product, doing site work, selling to home builders. When I came down, you know, we really kicked off what I'll call the institutional apartment development platform. One of the first deals I had to raise money for was in Santa Ana, California. It was a little bit of a fringe deal, 2015. And we got 100 no's, right? Because it was a fringe, I admit it was a fringe location, but there was vision. There was a metro stop coming in and you had to see the vision, but we did. And our land basis was super good. So we got 100 no's. I was like, oh, we're never going to be able to raise capital for this deal, right? My dad, great, you know, great mentor and coach. You know, keep trying, keep going. We'll get it done, right? And so eventually I got a term sheet and we were very excited. Well, this individual went to the site and goes, and they left us at the altar. They pulled out. So we kept going, right? Relentless persistence. And finally, we found the capital partner for the deal. Which is great. We ended up building it for $70 million. 3 years later, we sold it for $100 million-ish. And so that's, you know, that was a significant profit home run. And it, you know, we proved the vision. It was great. Well, after we closed that first, you know, institutional apartment JV, we went on to acquire more land sites, grow the company, bring in more US-based institutional LP equity partners, a lot of them investment funds, private equity groups. You know, from New York or LA, San Francisco, whatever, a lot of the big, you know, household name kind of institutional LPs. Then in 2019, we set out to bring in a single source, core, you know, kind of build to core long-term hold equity partner. And we finally found that group, right? In fact, we found them in 2019. They issued a term sheet. We were so thrilled. Spent a few months on JV docs, and fast forward to the February 2020. I was like, we're going to get this deal closed. Nothing could happen. Nothing could possibly happen that would cause this not to happen. I was like, war with North Korea? Nah, that's not going to happen. And then boom, COVID hit, right? The black swan crashed into Earth. Who would have thought? So we had to be extra hardworking and persistent and diligent in convincing this large build-a-core pension fund, Canadian pension fund, to proceed with this big venture with us and to commit to closing. We had an outside land closing date on an option in Burbank. We were heavily invested into the deal, eight digits into it. And if we didn't close, we would have lost it all, right? So it was like we were really under pressure. And we put backup plans in place, you know, as best we could, but it was a really difficult market. Well, fortunately, you know, as a result of an amazing capital partner, a really good deal at a great land basis that helped a ton, a lot of hard work and being in a good market, right? LA performs and did perform quite well in the Great Recession. So we had to prove that case up quite a bit. But luckily, we closed on the land. We closed the venture, got the $250 million equity commitment and went on to do a series of deals. And so that's the Canadian pension fund. And then, you know, as that process sort of unfolded, we also formed this self-storage venture. The group that introduced us, Macquarie, introduced us to the Canadian Pension Fund. And they came to us and wanted to work with us on this self-storage venture. It's an asset type we had been following and studying for some time. And given our entitlement expertise in Los Angeles, we're uniquely positioned because self-storage is, frankly, very few people build it. It's harder to entitle. Not a lot of people are doing it. And that's our expertise. We know the market really well. So there's a great opportunity to build a portfolio of, 2020s vintage self-storage assets. You know, we could sell a whole portfolio to a REIT in a few years or whatever. So anyway, we formed this great venture, had a couple of seed deals, brought in a guy from, 26-year storage veteran from Public Storage and before that Storage West. And we have a storage team focused on that asset class, and we got the commitment. And we're now acquiring, entitling, and developing self-storage. It's gone really well. We're ahead of schedule on those deals, and they're going. So that's how that kind of relationship morphed, right? So, it's been a lot of work for sure, and a lot of people working.
Well, what's amazing is these international institutional capital relationships mm-hmm. have been formed in really a short period of time. I mean, you came to the company in 2015. Your dad started the company in 2009. By the way, what did he do before 2009?
So he's done some great stuff. Just before that, he was building single family homes. Right before that music stopped, he was a single family home builder. Even going back before then, he was developing golf courses and driving ranges in urban infill locations, including mm-hmm. downtown Chicago, and built that company up, took it public, sold it to another public company.
Okay.
But he was doing single family homes. Yeah.
Yeah. Got it. And then to pivot then to, larger apartment communities, was it just when you came in, you had the institutional background of being a Prudential, but it's not like you started with a 30 or 50 or 100 unit deal. I mean, you started with a $70 million peak capitalization deal right out of the gates. And so not surprised that for the first deal, it was, what did you say? You went through 100 different groups before you found one.
Yeah.
Once you did that first one, then did the floodgates open, or you still had to prove the concept, had to go round trip, had to build out your team and internal controls in order to check all the boxes that these institutions require?
Yeah. Good point. When I joined, there was, five, six people. I don't know the exact number, seven people at Laterra. And we were really just starting the apartment development program. Granted, a lot of great experience, great people, obviously, when I joined, but this was our first big apartment deal. So it was super difficult, 100 no's, wanted to give up, thought it was going to be impossible. But we got it done, right? It just took finding that right investor at the right time to get it done, right? So that sort of persistence is super important. I would say that after we got that first deal done, the dam cracked and broke open, and it became easier, in part because we had all these, we had new capital relationships. We could point to a large deal that we were doing, but it would be fair to say that the second and third deal still took, quite a bit of effort. And as time progressed once we started round tripping deals, which we did, then it became easier, right? Because you can like point to a couple round trips. And so then it became even easier. But, I got to give credit to, our great capital partners, because that's the lifeblood of it at the end of the day.
So let's pivot to just what you're seeing out there in the construction world and construction costs. Obviously, over the last 18, 24 months with inflation, the cost of construction has gone up significantly. On the projects that you pro forma, let's say 2019 or even during COVID 2020, I mean, you couldn't imagine that construction costs would have increased so dramatically in 21 and 22. So assuming you entered into GMAX contracts, did contractors stand by those GMAX contracts that they entered into in 19 and 20, even in the when they were building your projects? I would assume construction costs skyrocketed.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, we went through you know, the greatest increase of costs, not just construction costs, but, you know, some of the highest inflation since the 1980s, right? And when the war in Ukraine happened, things got even worse. And, you know, so it costs increased to the eye-poppingly high, right, across the board. No, I learned that GMAX stands for guaranteed to pay the maximum number. We had a couple general contractors who just couldn't perform, who walked from the job. We had to take over. We started our own general contractor because of the challenges that stemmed, you know, from 2018, 2019, you know, kind of costs starting to go up and GC spread too thin and not performing well. We started that general contractor, and that's been a big and helpful change for us. Right. But no, it was very difficult. Right. I mean, the pandemic, and certain force majeure related things that came out of it, supply chain disruptions, labor shortages, that was difficult. Right. And costs went up. It was outside the control of, you know, anybody. And, you know, some partners, you know, react better to that than others. But at the end of the day, luckily for everybody, rents went up also, not in every submarket, in every city in the country. But it happened, right? There's two sides to the equation. So those markets where rents escalated faster than costs will perform better, right, than those that didn't. And there are some markets where rents escalated faster. Now, we'll see what happens this year, though. Some of those markets, you're going to see rent de-escalation. But anyway, it's, you know, it's difficult. But you know, just like everybody, we manage our way through it. We box in the risk as best as we can. We brought in the in-house GC, you know, and we're executing and getting it done.
Are you seeing costs come down?
We are seeing costs stabilize. Lumber's down. We're seeing some materials come down. Labor is starting to loosen up a little bit. So yeah, we're starting to see it. We are. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The fact that you have your own internal GC, do lenders or equity providers require that they hire independent third party, you know, construction management companies to oversee you and your GC, or how are their checks and balances with respect to that?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of the, you know, institutional development companies have affiliate general contractors. I think that's in some ways the natural progression, right? People go through the same growth and realize, hey, this, we really want to control this so that we could do a better job of delivering on time, on budget. So it's not uncommon for equity to work with developers with affiliate GCs, but not everybody does it. But yeah, they have, you're right, they have construction consultants for sure, but we keep a checks and balances, right? We view our GC as if it were a third party. They still sign, you know, the GMAX contract, you know, and we're the owner together with the equity, and they're the third party GC, and we wear different hats and have discussions, you know, in that capacity, right? So, so it's kind of the best of both worlds in many ways.
And so what are you trying to get to in terms of return on cost, or does it depend on the market? And I'm sure it changes based on multifamily versus self-storage.
My answer today is different than a year ago. You want my year ago or you want my today?
Well, yeah. Given that our podcast is going to be released tomorrow in a few weeks. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's keep it current. Well, for a self-storage deal, you know, you want to be 6.5 to 7 untrended return on costs, right? Mm-hmm. For an apartment development deal, you know, you want to be 6 handles. Depends if it's entitled or unentitled, but I'll simplify the answer. You want to be 150 basis points above today's cap rate. So if you think cap rates are, let's say, 4.25, 4.5, for example, you would want to be 150 basis points over that. So you'd want to be a 6, for example. Yeah, sure, 200 basis points is better. And it depends on the product type and the location, right? But generally, we just look at it relative to today's cap rates. And I think that's how most people are, you know, doing or should do it.
Got it. Okay. So then last year, your answer would have been still 150 basis points over the cap rate, but the overall number would have been about 50 basis points lower.
You got it. Yeah, that's exactly right. Yep. Yep.
So you mentioned Fry's Electronics a couple of times, and one in Burbank and other locations. Talk about how you forged a relationship with Fry's. And for those that don't know Fry's, maybe talk about what Fry's Electronics is, and how you got to that relationship, and why this relationship has become so strategic and central within Laterra development.
Sure. Yeah. So Fry's Electronics is an awesome electronics business chain, right? And so you may be familiar, like Fry's Burbank, there's a spaceship crashing into it. It's got a lot of personality. You know, that company was founded in San Jose. You know, it's kind of like the Peter Thiel, Elon Musk, PayPal Mafia, you know, tinkering with hard drive kind of thing up in Silicon Valley. Sort of came out of that, but it's iconic. And my dad is buddies with Randy Fry, went to his wedding. This is a while back. And so they're friends. Interestingly, Randy Fry was in Burbank meeting with the head of planning, because he has the Fry's Burbank store, trying to get a sense for what he could do there and what the zoning was and whatnot. And he asked the head of planning, Fred, he goes, who are the Burbank guys? Like, if I want to find a local development partner, like, who should I call? And he goes, well, we got these guys who just got something approved in Burbank. They're called Laterra Development. He's like, the guy's name is Charlie Tortolette and Chris Tortolette. He goes, oh my God, I know Charlie. I don't even need the card. I'll call him right now. Boom, called him on the spot. He's like, hey, I'm here with Fred. He's like, oh my God, Randy. You know, so, and they were friends. So that was a sort of fortuitous. So, you know, subsequently he came to our office, and, you know, we cut a high level deal on the redevelopment of the Fry's Burbank store, which was an easy thing. One, you know, they were friends too. We had the experience in Burbank and got one of the only deals, you know, approved there in 20 years done. And so, you know, worked through that deal. And then the relationship grew from there. It was, hey, I got a site in Irving, Texas, just north of Dallas, 19 and a half acres. Incredible. Irving, more Fortune 500 and Fortune 1000 companies than any city in the U.S. Yes, you know, Dallas has a lot of supply, but as a percentage of existing stock, it's number 27, not as high as most people think. That's an awesome market, right? So we just got approved there at city council. That's another great one for us. And then came Sacramento. That's an industrial deal. It's in the Northgate submarket along the 80 freeway. Super good top 10 industrial market in terms of rent growth and occupancy. And that one we got fully entitled as well. Got through planning commission and got appealed. That went away and we got our full entitlements. We're going to reposition the existing 155,000 square foot Fry store and then build another 110,000 square feet on the surface parking lot to get to 260 total. So that's a great one. And we got, you know, these are good deals. We're excited. He's great.
So all of them aren't pre-existing or former Fry's stores. Some aren't.
They're all former Fry's stores.
Oh, they are. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. And in a couple instances, we're going to reposition the store into a different use, like industrial. In other cases, we'll knock it down like in Burbank at the Hollywood Burbank Airport to build apartments. But they're all Fry stores, like 10 to 20 acre sites, awesome locations. Sure. Yeah.
I don't want you to have to, you know, divulge anything you don't feel comfortable divulging. But in our business, you know, we represent a lot of joint ventures where maybe it's a family office or a family that's not necessarily a real estate developer. They've owned land for a generation or two. They don't know how to develop real estate themselves. They partner with a real estate developer in a joint venture in which they contribute the land, and, you know, in some cases get a preferred return on the value of the land, and then they share in the profits thereafter. But the developer is responsible for either funding the capital or getting the third parties, equity investors to fund that capital. Is that a structure that I laid out, you know, similar to how you and Fry's have your relationship where they're contributing the land?
Yeah. Yeah. High level, right. They put land in, you know, at a pre-agreed upon value. We pay for entitlement costs. We get it entitled. And then we bring in, you know, the cap stack for the vertical and, you know, so yeah. Yeah. Kind of like that. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then how, after you've, developed and gotten CFO, how long thereafter are you owning, operating until you sell? Generally,
it just depends on who our equity partner is. We like holding long term for cash flow and tax benefits. Sure. Other funds, if we have an opportunity fund in the LP, they're going to want to sell. Sometimes it's a value add fund with a 5 to 7 year hold. Other times it's a long term hold. You know, so it just depends on the deal and the equity partner. Yeah.
Have you done any opportunity zone deals?
We got one. We're working through it right now. Yeah, we got one. And it's in Albuquerque. It's an awesome location. super good supply demand fundamentals and employment growth, and it's pretty interesting market.
How far away from the Netflix campus?
It's not anything in Albuquerque is 20 minutes or less. I learned whether it's Netflix or NBC Universal, or it's Sandia Labs or it's Intel semiconductor microchip processing facility, where all that stuff, it's all within like 10, 15 minutes, 20 minutes at the moment.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm surprised there. So you have one in Albuquerque, and when the Opportunity Zone law legislation came out, I'm thinking, what was it? Maybe 2017 or 18. You know, for multiple years, we were inundated with Opportunity Zone deals. Then after COVID, you know, it slowed down. Now, I mean, I may see an Opportunity Zone deal once every few months, very few and far between. Obviously, some of the tax benefits have gone away, but you still have the big tax benefit where if you hold for 10 years, then, you know, your step up in basis. And when you sell it, you know, you shouldn't be paying any taxes. Just curious, how come you haven't done more than just one?
Good question. We've gotten close on a couple. A lot of the investors don't like them in California because they don't get the benefit of the state, because the state doesn't care. Like, they still charge, you know, and so they're like, well, that sucks, unless it's a great deal. And so, you know, that's been part of it. But we've identified, you know, a few opportunities. But look, we're of the opinion that an opportunity zone can't turn a mediocre or bad deal good, but it can make a good deal better, right? Yeah. And so that's been our mindset. So some people, not all, but some, I think, are doing less than good deals because they're op zone deals. We don't look at it like that. Like, it's got to be a great deal, and we got to like the location and the supply demand fundamentals, and even the micro location, right? So that's like narrowed the field down considerably for us.
Yeah, look, in the beginning, you know, people were just chasing the tax benefit. And I said, the deal has to stand alone.
It does. Totally.
The developer has to be a quality developer who has a great track record. And don't be chasing tax savings, because you will end up losing your principal instead of just saving on taxes.
Yeah.
All right. So I want to cover two things before we depart. So one, done many closings in my career, and, you know, sometimes they'll culminate with a closing lunch, a closing dinner. I've been invited to a closing golf celebration, other trips. Never have I ever had a closing where someone has pulled out a gong. Ooh. And that someone is you, Chris. Can you explain the history of the banging of the gong? And maybe we can share with my audience the one time you banged that gong with me and what happened.
Sure. Well, at Laterra, we like to celebrate wins, both big and small. I think that's important. Yep. And so the way we do that, one of the big ways, is we hit a gong, right? It's a tradition. In fact, we have something called the 10 Gong Commandments.
By the way, this is not just a mini gong. This is a full size.
Yeah, this thing's big, gong. Right?
Big. It's heavy.
It's heavy. Yeah. So we got the 10 Gong Commandments. You know, for example, the mallet is not a microphone. You know, swing, right? No fixing your hair after you swing unless it's a head hit gong. No one's done the head hit, but anyway, they're great, right? So yeah.
You have good hair though, so you should fix it if you mess it up.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Yes, and so, as you know, we closed our Marina Del Rey deal. And, you know, as I said, you went through thick and thin with us on that. That was a difficult transaction.
Yeah, we could do a whole podcast on that one transaction.
We will.
Yeah.
So, of course, we decided, let's do a happy hour, right, at Italy, at the roof, at Terra, at the rooftop. And it was a beautiful sunny day, 5 o'clock, 5:30, whatever. And we invited the bank. We invited, you know, the debt. We invited, you know, you and a few others, people from Laterra, whoever, everybody was invited. Mm-hmm. So we had a big table, you know, 15 of us or 20, whatever. Nice day, not that crowded, but there were some people there.
There
were people for sure, but it wasn't packed, but it was an open air setting. We'll say that.
Fair enough.
And of course I pulled out the gong. Who wants to hit the gong? Right. Nice surprise. Pull out of a box. Well, I won't say who, somebody stepped up to hit the gong. It wasn't either of you or me. It was somebody on the debt side. And I said, you know, you know, give it a nice hit, right? And so he hits the gong right on the rooftop of Eataly. And I should caveat this before I say, I'll say, I get a variety of responses when I hit the gong in public places that range anywhere from a round of applause to, you know, an eye roll would be the worst. And mm-hmm. so that's sort of the range. Well, this one fell out the range, right? So he hits the gong and, you know, it kind of, people are kind of looking around, whatever, normal stuff, didn't get the applause I was hoping for. And all of a sudden this guy, you know, he jumps up from his table and he runs over. It's like, are you guys out of your mind? It's like, what are you doing? You know, and we were very polite, of course, right? Hey, sorry, we're celebrating a big closing. We had a table full of wine and it was quite nice. We apologized, you know, bought his wine, whatever. But he, you know, he was not pleased with the situation by any stretch. He went to go tell mall security. They came up and it was odd because she's like, what was it? You know, we show her the gong. Hey, sorry, it was a celebration. We'll put it away. And she's like, let me see it. We show her. She starts taking pictures of the gong. This isn't like a crime scene. You know, I'm like, Andrew, I hope we don't get in trouble.
Where's the body? Drawing an outline.
Yeah, but it was innocent. You know, we you know, made, tipped the restaurant huge, you know, bought a couple of drinks for the upset guy. But so that was not a good gong reaction. Generally, the reactions are good. And in fact, you might hear a gong hit soon all the way down on floor three.
Oh, I love it. Well, yeah. Look, for the audience, it did, even though I knew it was coming. Let's see, we had an earthquake, a couple nights ago
yes.
in LA, like a 4.2 or 4.4 epicenter uh-huh. in the ocean. And that startled the crap out of me at 2 a.m. That reaction was the same reaction that our friend in the table next to us had when that gong was rung or struck. And I think he levitated at least 3 feet out of his chair. It was quite the sight to see.
Yes. Well, it's, you know, going forward in public, you know, important to, you know, tell the hitter of the gong, you know, to mind their surroundings. But, you know, overall, I'd say it was an overreaction. But again,
it's easy for you to say.
Easy for me to
say. All right. Last topic, and then I'll let you go. Snow globe.
Yes.
What is Snow Globe?
Sure. So Snow Globe is a very large music festival. In fact, MTV acquired it that I co-founded. And I'll tell you this.
What year did you co-found it?
Sure. So co-founded it in 2011. MTV acquired it in 2018. It's in mm-hmm. South Lake Tahoe, California. At its peak, drew over 50,000 people, you know, over the 3 days. It was a 3-day event, a New Year's event, like one of the biggest, you know, music festivals, ticketed New Year's Eve events like in the country. So it turned out to be a big thing. It's a passion project.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I'll tell you the story, the story of, you know, how did I get started in it, right?
Because usually the last couple of minutes of a podcast, I do a lightning round. So yeah. if you weren't, my first question is always, if you weren't in the real estate business, what would you be doing? Is it safe to say music festival?
You know what? I would say that it was a great execution and round trip, and I'm happy I'm not in the music business anymore. And so, you know, I don't know if I would have lasted, to be honest, but it worked out really well. Certainly it was intriguing and a passion project. Yeah. And so, you know, kind of rewind to 2010, right? I actually worked at Prudential, at PGIM, the real estate private equity side of Prudential Financial. Great company and amazing people. But, you know, I sought more excitement in my life. I'm an entrepreneur at heart. And by the way, I'll note that, because this is important, that I only worked on this music festival endeavor at night and on the weekend, never at the office or using company computers, whatever, because that's important to me, right? You got to be ethical in that way. But I did work a lot on the nights and weekends on my own time after I got home, and I love music, right? And I still do. I don't get a chance to go out, you know, see live music as much as I used to. But 2010, right? I was like 25 years old. I discovered a brand new music festival had launched in Vail Valley, Colorado. And I knew I wanted to go, but I didn't have the funds to justify a cross-country party trip, right? So I asked myself, how can I get free tickets for me and all my friends? And it occurred to me, I got to add some value here. I got to demonstrate value. So it occurred to me that a new music festival, they needed to be able to reach all these people in California. And I had great, you know, I had friends who lived in different markets who could help me promote it. So I put together a new promotion company and a business plan. on how we could help him reach this, you know, a whole new market. Couldn't find the guy's email, the founder's email. So I went to the website, found Lost and Found at Snowball Music Festival, sent a business plan into the abyss of a Lost and Found email. A few days went by, crickets. Then finally he called me, loved the business plan. He thought it was professional. I was hired. So we had this, we launched the street team, marketing, guerrilla marketing execution. Went great. Festival went great. We lived up to our end of the bargain and did well. And then it occurred to me, I wanted to, you know, be a founder myself. And so ultimately realized, hey, this is a full-time job. It's a lot of work, right? It was me and my buddies. And so we brought in, and actually we partnered with, I should say, the Snowball founder. And my job was to raise the capital, you know, got to give the Snowball founder a lot of credit for the execution, of course, but my job was to raise the capital, right? And structure the deal for what was the first snow globe in South Lake Tahoe. And I like to point out, you know, that I didn't have a lot of experience or any experience in the music business, right? So I used a skill I call knowledge transfers, and I took what I learned in real estate, right? Excel modeling and pro formas for apartment development deals, and I applied that to the music business, rent growth and apartment rent was ticket sales and OPEX ratios transferred and whatnot, put together a waterfall and structured the deal and the transaction. I ended up raising the capital, which was super exciting. And then we launched the first year, and the event was a huge success, and it, wow, you know, turned out to be great.
That's incredible. And just to have such a different business and passion than real estate, I mean, it must be gratifying. I want to head right into the lightning round because I know we're short on time. So I'm going to go right into Snow Globe. Best act that you had at Snow Globe.
That really depends on who you're asking. You know, we had,
how about most high profile?
Most high profile, probably Tiesto. If you know who that is, Snoop Dogg was another big one.
Snoop Dogg. Wow. I saw him at the Super Bowl last year.
Yeah. He was good. But we had a lot of, you know, indie rock, electronic, hip hop. It was good. We had some huge names. Yeah.
That's great. All right. If you could tell your 25-year-old self one thing about the next 10, 15 years of Chris's life from what, 10, 15 years ago?
Yeah.
What would it be? What would the one thing be to the younger Chris?
Just be patient and be persistent, right? Don't get down with no's and challenges, and you know, keep forging ahead, and it'll all work out.
One market that you haven't yet done a deal in, but you would like to?
It's a good question because it's changed. You know, I had the Phoenix and Scottsdale envy the last couple of years, but now I don't have that envy anymore. And we finally got our deal in Dallas. I think Atlanta is another good market that I like a lot. You know, all across the Sun Belt I like, but I'll go with, you know, I could go with Atlanta, greater Atlanta. Some of the suburban markets there for BTR are good.
Let's say in 5 years from now, will you be doing more deals outside of California or within California?
If you aggregate the entire country into one, maybe more deals outside, but we're certainly going to be doing them here too.
Sure. All right, Chris, I can't thank you enough for your time and just your candor. It's really been just a wonderful opportunity to explore Laterra development, talk about you, talk about your other hobbies as well. And I just really appreciate you coming on to Real Talk. You're a great friend, client, and colleague and peer. And best success to you, your father, and the rest of the Laterra crew.
Thank you, sir. I enjoyed it. Appreciate it. Thanks, everybody, for tuning in.
All right, Chris, take care.
Take care. Bye.
You've been listening to Real Talk, Real Estate Discussions with Andrew Kirsch. You can catch prior episodes at www.sklarkirsch.com and on YouTube, LinkedIn, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and more. Thank you for your positive reviews, comments, and sharing this show with others.